You can bet on all kinds of things in Las Vegas. During last year's Super Bowl, you could bet on, of course, who was going to win. But you could also bet on what color Katy Perry's hair was going to be when she began singing at halftime. Would Idina Menzel screw up the lyrics to the Star Spangled Banner? What color was the Gatorade going to be that the winning team dumped on the coach? You could even bet on which team Barack Obama was going to pick to win. But there are some bets that Las Vegas just will not take.
Hello.
Is this Bob Scucci?
It is, yes.
It's David Kestenbaum with National Public Radio.
Hi, David.
Bob Scucci works at the Orleans Casino in Las Vegas. His friends all call him Scooch. Scooch is a bit of a legend. He is famous for being able to figure out what the odds would be on basically anything. And he is in charge of setting the initial odds at casinos around town for things like who is going to win the Super Bowl. So I have a different request.
Okay.
I'd like to make a bet on who the next U.S. president is going to be.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people are interested in stuff like that. Unfortunately, in Nevada, some of the gaming control board regulations prohibit us from betting, from making wagers on any elections.
It's illegal.
Yep.
This was not always the case. We let people bet on horse races, so why not the horse race? Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm David Kestenbaum. Today, I am joined again by our gambling correspondent, Keith Romer. Can I call you gambling correspondent?
My mother is going to be very pleased with that job title.
Today on the show, we make the case for why betting on elections should be allowed.
Gambling could be good for you.
This episode of Planet Money and the following message are made possible by Scion. Proud to support Planet Money, where you can learn about things like the economics of haggling. At Scion, their pure price offer means you don't need to haggle for price when you shop for a Scion car. Learn more at scion.com.
Quick note before we start, there is this thing at the University of Iowa where you can bet small amounts of money on the election, but it's basically a research thing. In the sense that we usually mean it, it is illegal in the United States to take bets on the outcome of the presidential election.
It's perfectly legal to spend $1 million on lobbyists or to buy $1 million worth of ads, but you want to give that money to a bookie to bet on who you think will win? You can't do it.
One argument against betting on elections is that elections are just too important to mess with. You know, it's one thing to gamble on the Super Bowl, but this is the future of our country.
But there were plenty of times in history where people were allowed to bet on elections. I speak, of course, of 16th century Rome.
They were super into gambling back then. People would bet on sports like we do now, like horse races, tennis matches. There was some early form of croquet.
They would find a woman from the neighborhood who was pregnant, and they would bet whether she was going to have a boy or a girl.
I love that one. Totally random and also really hard to rig.
The big bets, though, were on elections, the most sacred of all elections. Who is the next pope going to be?
For Rome, that's the be-all, end-all event.
They're betting on who the next pope is going to be.
Yeah, it's called Scommesse di fare il Papa.
This is historian John Hunt. And John has spent a lot of time in Italy going through very old documents in the Vatican Library and in this other place called the Vatican Secret Archives. Sometimes he's looking at documents that no one has seen in hundreds of years. And he says if you look back at these things, they tell an amazing story of this betting frenzy that would take place whenever a new pope was being elected.
The church didn't want people betting on who the next pope would be. In fact, the whole process was supposed to be secret.
Here's how it worked. When the pope died, the cardinals would all get called to Rome to elect a new one. This is basically what happens today. The cardinals all go into the Vatican Palace, and the doors are locked behind them. Gatherings called the conclave.
Conclave is from the Latin meaning conclave, with key. So they actually put them into a confined space, and if they aren't electing a pope within a good amount of time, actually their rations are reduced. So they no longer get the fine wine or food. Instead, they're supposed to just survive, you know, some like bread and water.
Apparently, they built these little cells for the cardinals to sleep in inside there. I had real trouble imagining the whole thing. Finally, John Hunt put it this way.
It's a big sleepover with cardinals, and they're all going to elect the new pope.
A sleepover that lasts for many, many, many nights. And you cannot leave.
Yes.
You want a sacred election? This was supposed to be sacred. They were in there working out the will of God. It was a holy, holy business.
Outside the locked gates, though, gambling. Lots and lots of gambling on who the cardinals were going to pick.
a small-time artisan might bet, you know, 5, 10, 20 scudi, which is a lot of money. 3 scudi was, you know, 3 gold coins. That's a salary for a month.
That's at the low end. Some bets were a lot bigger.
Some of these banking houses would go up to tens, 20, 30,000 gold scudi.
30,000 scudi? What could 30,000 scudi get me?
It's hard to put it into modern-day terms, but let's just say that would be hundreds of thousands of dollars. It would get you a lot.
That's a big bet.
Yeah.
When there's money at stake, people do all kinds of weird things. You can imagine a cardinal maybe takes a bribe to throw the vote one way or the other, sort of like a basketball player, a baseball player takes a bet on a game that he's playing in.
Money can be corrupting. It can make people do things they wouldn't do otherwise. So you know how in the U.S. in elections today, we have the curtains around the voting booth so that you can make the decision without being influenced by somebody outside? That was the same idea back then. That's why they locked the doors to the palace. And yet, in part because people had all this money on it, things kept leaking out from the Vatican.
The palace is locked, but there are holes. You have to be able to get food and supplies in somehow. There's a turning wheel in the wall, sort of like a Lazy Susan or something, where they send those things into the palace.
Somebody passed a glove through the turning wheel, and inside the glove was a note. And another good case is Cardinal Antonio Barberini. He actually carved a little hole out near his cell that gave him a little crack so he could talk to the outside world.
Sneaky guy.
He's very sneaky. These secrets get out so much that there's this whole news business that pops up to relay all the latest gossip. There are these handwritten newsletters called avvisi. And in the avvisi, you can read, oh, you know, Cardinal Del Monte is up to 22 votes, but Cardinal Pole only has 16 votes.
I think of it like 16th century Twitter.
The church tries all kinds of things to stop this information from getting out. They fortify the palace.
More guards. They would also reinforce all the doors.
They tell all the clergy in the palace, come on, no more leaking. They get everyone to promise.
They swear in a Bible that, you know, they will desist from leaking information, not talk to the outside world, not spread any more gossip.
Does it work?
I would say no. Information is still leaking out. They even made an example of a few people by, you know, having some people tortured, and it didn't stop. Because information is important, particularly, you know, I mean, this is going to be the father of the Holy Church, the new prince of Rome. Everybody is on pins and needles waiting to find out who it's going to be.
People loved betting on who the next pope was going to be. There are even records, he says, of cardinals making wagers with each other. Wasn't there one over a cow or something?
A she-mule, I believe.
What is a she-mule?
It's a lady mule.
Oh, I see. Yeah. People you really think should not be betting are betting. Like when Pope Sextus V dies, he's a guy who was super opposed to gambling, his sister starts placing bets on who is going to replace him. My brother's just died. She then places bets on who the next pope is going to be.
You could look at this story and say, you see, that's what happens when you allow betting. It's a total mess.
But John Hunt, the historian, says, look, there were all kinds of shenanigans and bribes going on back then. And it had nothing to do with betting. Like, kings would bribe cardinals. They would offer gifts or money or titles. But that was just because they wanted there to be a French pope or a Spanish pope. You know, the pope was an incredibly powerful person, and they wanted an ally to have the job.
He says the conclave was always this super political, even sometimes mercenary process. It was never all that sacred to begin with. And, Hunt says, if you think of the gambling from the point of view of the common people, it was a good thing, all the gambling. It encouraged all those leaks.
People knew what was going on in the election, so it made the election process more transparent. Now, for the cardinals and papal officials, they were horrified by this. You know, the conclave was supposed to be secret. It was supposed to be guided by the divine Holy Spirit. But it was a human event, and common people throughout Rome knew what was going on.
In a way they might not if the gambling hadn't existed.
Exactly. And that was perhaps a good thing.
Betting, not so bad. And okay, you can look at this story and say, well, that's 16th century Rome, 500 years ago. Maybe betting on elections then wasn't so bad. I wouldn't want to try that in the United States. But here is a second story from U.S. history. I didn't know this, but for much of American history, it was totally fine to bet on who the next president was going to be. Here's Paul Rode. He's an economic historian at the University of Michigan.
It was very common at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, for people to take a lot of interest in elections, to go downtown on election night. people would go congregate. It would be like a big game, like a Super Bowl, and they would bet with one another.
Some of the bets, he told us, were about money. You lose, you have to fork over some cash. But you could also make these other different kinds of bets with people, too.
When you lose, you have to push them around in a wheelbarrow or carry them on your back or shave your face in front of them so that they can see, you know, they won, you lost. They'd be eating crow, et cetera.
People actually eat crow? Is that a real thing?
Yes. They had to eat crows.
It was an amazing thing, he says, the kind of thing you just do not see today. People with opposite views actually talking to each other, talking about who they wanted to run the country, and then making this crazy bet. This was an engaged electorate.
Whether you think having money at stake is a good reason or a bad reason for people to care about the outcome of elections, it really did draw them in. Just think about, like, the NCAA tournament, how suddenly passionate Jerry in accounting gets about North Dakota State just because he picks them in his pool. He wants the money. He wants the bragging rights. He wants to win his bet.
It was the same thing back then with bets on who the next U.S. president was going to be. In fact, by like 1900, it became this huge thing. There were these betting commissioners in downtown New York taking these bets at a place called the Curb Exchange, which is basically an extension of Wall Street.
And just like news about what stocks are up and down get reported in the press, so do the odds from the presidential betting.
It would literally be like I would pick up a newspaper, open it up, I could look at the bottom of a page, whatever, and there it would have the odds on the presidential election.
It'd be above the fold.
Oh, above the fold.
That really impressed you, Kestenbaum.
Above the fold is where every journalist wants their story to be. It means the top half of the front page. So when the paper's sitting there, it's like the first thing you see. And that's where the odds were.
Betting on the next president is allowed because, you know, why not? But also because it turns out to serve this really useful function. It supplies the country with something that they really wanted. Information. Information that went beyond pundits saying, oh, Woodrow Wilson's going to win. No, Charles Hughes is going to win.
Woodrow Wilson won.
Yeah, Wilson won that one.
They don't have Gallup polls yet. They don't have scientific polls yet. This is a way of seeing whether people are really willing to put their money where their mouth is. And then it turns out that the odds are remarkably accurate in this period.
Of the 15 presidential elections between 1884 and 1940, the betting market correctly calls the race in 11. It's too close to call in 3, and they only get one wrong.
Behold the wisdom of the markets. Now, people made arguments back then against betting on elections. One concern was that it might lead to vote buying. So here's how that might work. You could imagine, like, somebody placing a big bet on their candidate that their candidate was going to win, then telling a bunch of people, look, vote for my guy. When he wins, I'm going to give you a bunch of money. So they do that. Your candidate wins. You win the bet. You take that money and use it to pay off the voters who voted your way. It's clever, but Rhodes says there is no evidence that anything like that ever happened. Just like none.
In the end, betting on who the next president will be does go away, but for all these funny little reasons. In 1939, the state of New York, where most of the election betting was taking place, New York legalizes horse track gambling. You can bet on actual horse races. So now if you want your gambling fix, you don't have to wait 4 years to get it.
Also, there were scientific polls coming along at this time, like the Gallup poll. And when you have scientific polls, you know, the newspapers don't have to report the gambling odds anymore.
And finally, the New York Stock Exchange and the Curb Exchange, where all the betting is taking place, they get cold feet. They ban their members from taking election bets.
They want to make a distinction. They don't want people to say, oh, all that activity on Wall Street is gambling.
Isn't Wall Street kind of gambling?
Well, it is.
I can just imagine the Wall Street traders and brokers saying, hey, we're doing capital allocation. This is not gambling. And, you know, there's some truth to that.
There's some truth to it. It seems, though, that in the end, the real rationale for these new laws that ban election betting is still the old one we saw back in the 1500s. The elections are sacred things, and we want them to be clean. And gambling to some people just feels icky.
Paul Rode, the economic historian, says there are times when he wishes people could place bets on who the president is going to be. In particular, he wishes that when an election is coming up and all those experts are on TV just blathering on.
I don't know how many times I've seen a pundit on the TV say something that I know is just completely wrong and said basically, you know, I have $1,000 that says you're wrong. And I suspect that if they had to put up money, they would be more cautious about the false statements or the misleading statements they're making.
Should we allow betting on who the next president is going to be in the United States?
I don't get into that. I don't see the harm.
You don't see the harm in it?
I don't see the harm in it.
And the history of it is that it was sort of useful in some ways and not obviously harmful.
Not obviously harmful, no.
One more thing about gambling. It's really hard to actually kill. You outlaw it in some place, it just crops up somewhere else. There's always somebody who's willing to say, hey, come on over. We'll take your bet.
Afternoon, Matthew speaking.
It's David Kestenbaum with National Public Radio.
Oh, hi, Dave. How are you?
This is Matthew Shattuck, another bookmaker. And as you can probably tell from his accent, he's British. He works for a place called Ladbrokes. And in England, betting on who the next U.S. president is going to be, that is perfectly legal. In fact, people are already placing bets for 2016.
Yeah, an awful lot of money, hundreds of thousands of pounds staked on that with Ladbrokes already, thousands of bets. And worldwide, there'll be hundreds of millions of pounds bet on the outcome of the election.
Hundreds of millions of pounds?
I'm very, very confident about that. Probably this will be the biggest political betting event ever.
Shattuck says the American system is perfect for betting. It's a clean head-to-head competition. There's almost always just two candidates. You have all the primaries. The whole thing builds like a soccer tournament or the NFL playoffs.
He was really jealous of it because the British system is more complicated. He's like, oh, you guys did it just right. Shattuck ran through the odds for us, if you're curious. Hillary Clinton so far is leading. There are even odds on her, which means that if you bet $1 and she wins, you win $1.
Jeb Bush is second favorite at 7-2.
That means that if you bet $2 and he wins, you get 7?
You win 7, plus you get your $2 back. So you make a $7 profit on your 2 stake.
Donald Trump, 10-1. He was 200-1 a few weeks ago. Bernie Sanders is 14-1.
He was a little worse before, right?
He was 20-1 before.
Look, I'm not a gambler, but I just do not see a good reason for why betting on who the next president is going to be should be illegal. I mean, in Rome, they bet on who the Pope was going to be. We here in the United States used to bet on who the next president is going to be. People right now are betting on who the U.S. president is going to be, just not here. Although I guess I don't really see the point of it. Like, what would we get out of it?
Imagine if everybody filled out a primaries bracket the same way they did for March Madness. People would be so engaged.
Like who you got for Iowa?
Right, exactly. And if you win, you make a lot of money.
I never win. Since we could not make a bet with Scooch, the bookmaker in Las Vegas, about the next U.S. presidential election, we did ask him what else we might be able to bet on. I hear you can set odds on anything.
You really can, you know, and over the years we've had requests to put up odds on various events. You could do it on almost any event, you know, Dancing with the Stars and you know, American Idol. You could do it on almost anything.
How about a lobster fighting a cat? Odds for the lobster?
We can actually do that, sure. Well, I'm making the cat a little bit of a favor. He's very agile. It's going to be tough for him to get the claws through the shells, but I'm giving the big edge to the cat.
How is a cat ever going to beat a lobster?
Kind of turn him over on its side, and once he gets him on its back, it's all over.
I'll take that bet.
All right.
I'm going with the lobster.
Who you got, Planet Money listeners? You team lobster or you team cat?
Let us know. You can send us email, planetmoney@npr.org. Special thanks today to Walter Champion. He's professor of law at Texas Southern University, Thurgood Marshall School of Law. Also to our intern, Darian Woods, who helped out with this one. Our show today was produced by Nadia Wilson. Thank you, Nadia. And now that you're done listening to this podcast, NPR recommends checking out Alt Latino. They have tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexico. What more could you want? You can find Alt Latino at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Keith Romer. Thanks for listening.